WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with military historian Clay Blair. His new book, The Forgotten War, examines the Korean War, a war marked by out-of-date U.S. military strategy, racism in the military, and McCarthyism at home. Also today, I speak with film director Bob Swaim, best known for his French film La Balance. He describes his new film, Masquerade, as a film noir for the 80s. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new compact disc release of the late Arturo Toscanini, not in performance, in rehearsal. And humorist Alice Kahn examines one of the oddest but longest-lasting relationships around, Ken and Barbie. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Many Americans remember the Korean War primarily for its role as the setting of the TV series MASH. Military historian Clay Blair calls the Korean War the Forgotten War, but he thinks we shouldn't allow it to slip from our collective memory. He would like to remind us that close to 4.5 million people on both sides were murdered, wounded, or incapacitated as a result of the war. American intervention in Korea helped set the stage for our involvement in Vietnam. And the Korean War fostered a national climate in America that strengthened the appeal of McCarthyism. The United States sent troops to Korea in 1950 after communist troops from North Korea invaded the South. The war ended in 1953 after a negotiated settlement. Historian Clay Blair is a former military correspondent for Time magazine and the author of the bestseller Silent Victory about the U.S. submarine war against Japan. His new book, The Forgotten War, America in Korea, is published by Times Books. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York and asked him why he thought Korea had become the forgotten war.
Possibly because after 1 year of very difficult and dramatic and exciting fighting, the war bogged down into negotiations that went on for about 2 years, and the fighting continued, but the news became very boring. These negotiations were very complex. The story drifted off the first front pages and were put, you know, in the back of the paper. There was no TV to remind us. The people were against the war, and they were very happy not to hear about it. And then we segue it into the Eisenhower years, where, as you know, the Eisenhower generation was not demonstrative, not rebellious, and sort of bland. And so, I don't know, for a number of reasons, it just drifted off into history and is not remembered.
There are a lot of themes from the Korean War that have remained themes in American military and politics. For instance, the Korean War was the first war that we fought to contain the spread of communism.
Yes, this is true. Up until that time, we had been engaged in what was known as the Cold War. This was the first hot war in our relationship with Moscow. Up to this time, as a matter of fact, we had more or less disarmed as a nation. We had cut our defense forces, conventional forces, to the bone, and had virtually no military power. One result of the Korean War was that we rearmed, the whole nation rearmed, and we remain so to this day, a militaristic state. I think that was one of the most significant outcomes of the Korean War, often forgotten.
The war in Korea was different strategically than any war we had fought before. How were the battle conditions, for instance, different than they were in World War II?
Well, in a number of ways. Korea is a very mountainous, forbidding place with terrible weather, very bitterly cold in the winter and jungle hot in the summer. It's a peninsula, somewhat like Italy or even Vietnam. And we attempted at first to go in and fight a war that we, a duplicate of World War II in Europe. And this, we were road bound. We were relying on heavily on artillery and other conventional means of fighting a war. And in fact, the enemy was a guerrilla type of fighter, as they were in later in Vietnam. So we had to really change our outlook about how we fought wars.
Were the generals mostly generals who had fought during World War II and were basically fighting as if it were still World War II?
Yes, this was one of the mistakes we made early in the war. All the generals, most of the generals in Korea, were so-called European generals who were serving in Japan at this time for a little variety in their career. MacArthur, of course, had fought the Japanese all through the Pacific, but he was far removed from the battlefield in Korea. So there was a tendency to repeat what had occurred in Europe, and this did not work against an enemy who had small regard for human life and whose tactics were mass attacks regardless of casualties or the consequences.
We mentioned the strategy that the Koreans and also the Chinese had during the war of just continuing to mass. And I think from the way you describe it, the number of soldiers, both Chinese and Korean, just really astonished the American generals who were masterminding the war. Now, General MacArthur, who headed up military strategy during the first part of the war, said that basically that he didn't believe that the Chinese could fight a modern army. Was that the general consensus among the American strategists?
It certainly was. MacArthur, you see, I should explain that to our listeners that this war was in two phases. First, the North Koreans invaded South Korea, and we defeated them, and we were well on our way to a good victory. The thinking was, MacArthur said, that the Chinese would not come into the war. And even if they did, as you say, he had such contempt for them as fighters that he would destroy them within a matter of a few weeks, mostly with air power. So when we went into North Korea to liberate North Korea, the Chinese, in fact, did come in huge numbers, as you say, hundreds and hundreds of thousands, without artillery, without air power, without trucks, without radios, and they flung themselves at our forces without any regard for conventional ideas about saving lives or casualties. And we had a very, very difficult time for a period of about 2 months. We were thrown back. We suffered tremendous casualties, all this forgotten, by the way. And there was very grave danger that we would be thrown out altogether, out of Korea. But we were fortunate in that by circumstances, a new general came, Matthew Ridgway, and he took the army that was in full retreat, almost rout, and by his own personal courage and example, turned the army around, and we went on to actually defeat the Chinese. We beat them. We crushed them. We annihilated them by perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps in total almost a million casualties were inflicted. Then the Chinese asked for talks, and these talks went on for 2 years, and as I said earlier, they were very frustrating. People became disgusted with the war. It was a new idea in terms of strategy, which was to settle for the status quo, which introduced the concept of a limited war. We had never fought a limited war before. We always went for victory. In this case, we decided that it wasn't worth the effort, that we would settle the war out on the 38th parallel where it started, and accept a compromise. And this turned a lot of people against the war because, as MacArthur says, there was no substitute for victory.
Well, a couple of things that you mentioned really sound like themes that were played out again during the war in Vietnam. For instance, to get back to something you were saying a couple of minutes ago, you were discussing how the American military didn't believe that the Chinese would be effective in fighting against a modern army. Now, wasn't it the same way in Vietnam? Didn't we go in there thinking that for sure we would win easily because we had a sophisticated army?
Yes, I think, and not only that, this idea arose in Korea. You have to remember that the young captains and company commanders, platoon leaders, and so on, who fought the Chinese and beat them in Korea, were, by the time of Vietnam, colonels and generals. So they had come out of Korea with the idea that you could, in fact, fight Asians on Asian soil and beat them. This was a, totally at odds with what our doctrine had been. Our doctrine had been never fight Asians in Asia, because it was a losing proposition. Because we had won the war in Korea, these young officers who were in command positions at the time of Vietnam unhesitatingly felt that we could go into Vietnam and easily defeat another Asian army, which did not appear at first to be as formidable as the Chinese.
Isn't there an expression in military history that generals always fight the previous war?
There certainly is, and that was true in the Korean War, and again, I think in Vietnam.
So in the Korean War, we were fighting World War II, and in Vietnam, we were fighting the Korean War.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
And I hope that we don't repeat this mistake.
What are some of the other ways you think that the Korean War set the stage for Vietnam?
Well, as I said, I think the primary thing was the mindset, the confidence, the overconfidence that it instilled in the professional Army officer corps. I can't think of any other, offhand, any other reasons that how this war set a stage, other than to reinforce our belief that we should interfere in nationalistic civil wars in the Far East, which in my opinion is a terrible mistake.
Clay Blair is my guest. He's a military historian whose new book is titled The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. Now, Americans suffered terrible casualties during the Korean War, especially during the first part of the war, when the American troops were really unprepared for the kind of fight that they were fighting. Yet, there was never the kind of anti-war movement at home during the Korean War that there was during the Vietnam War. Why do you think that was so?
Right. Well, I think the reason for this is this. When the Korean, all during the post-war period from 1945 until 50, the Russians had been pushing us around. The communists had been pushing us around in Berlin, in Eastern Europe, and other places. And I think that the general tenor, the feeling among Americans was, we've got to stop Joe Stalin from pushing us around. And when Truman committed us into Korea in order to save South Korea from the communists, the country was really nearly 100% behind him. Let's go. Let's beat these communists. Let's draw the line. Let's show them they can't push us around anymore. So that for a full year, the country supported the Korean War in a most magnificent and patriotic way. It was only when the war, after the first year, when it bogged down in these interminable negotiations, which were very confusing to people, the casualties went on at this, very, very high rate, that people began to turn against the war and express total dissatisfaction with it. But again, I think to demonstrate, to rebel, to hold open riots of any of that type of thing that occurred during the Vietnam War was not the style of the early 1950s of the Eisenhower generation. And even though there was widespread dissatisfaction, nobody burned a draft card.
Well, didn't, in fact, the Korean War help create a climate that made McCarthyism possible?
Yes, that's a very good point. McCarthyism was intensified. Once we got into a shooting war, McCarthyism and all kinds of repressive ideologies became very widespread in this country, because communists were actually killing Americans in Korea by the thousands, and so there was a natural tendency to fall for large segments of the population to get behind McCarthy and other ideologues like that.
The Korean War was the first post-nuclear war. We had already used the atom bomb in Japan. Everybody knew that we had the atom bomb. Did the United States ever seriously consider using atomic weapons in Korea during the war?
Yes, we did. On a number of occasions, this was very intensely studied. The problem is that the Chinese were so good at camouflage that they were hiding in the mountains, in the valleys and gorges, and never, at no time, in fact, did they ever present a good target, if you will. In other words, one that would be worth an atomic bomb. And because of this, in the mountainous terrain, there was a reluctance to use atomic bombs because, A, they wouldn't be effective. B, if they weren't effective, the negative psychological impact would undermine our deterrent. However, during two or three really tense moments when we thought we were going to be thrown out and that the Chinese or North Koreans would create a Dunkirk, a bloody withdrawal for us, and would have to mass in front of our lines to do that, this was very seriously considered. But again, the worldwide consequences of using an atomic weapon against these primitive Asians would have been, I think, perhaps even disastrous.
Well, what effects do you think the Korean War had on the arms race between the United States and the Soviet Union and China?
Well, I think it fueled it beyond belief. As I said earlier, we had disarmed almost completely before the Korean War. During the Korean War, our government approved a massive rearmament program that goes on right to this day. So it all stems from that conflict. And that was one of the most significant consequences of that war.
My guest is Clay Blair. He's a military historian whose new book is titled The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Military historian Clay Blair is my guest, author of a new book about the Korean War. You bring up a very interesting chapter of military history, and that is the segregation and then the desegregation of America's military. Ever since the Civil War, the troops in America had been officially segregated. In 1948, Truman asked for the desegregation of the troops. Yet, when the Korean War started in 1950, the troops were still segregated. Why hadn't desegregation actually occurred yet?
Well, what you say is true. The Army had segregated blacks within its ranks since the Civil War. And Truman signed an executive order in 1948, a very famous document, asking the Army, Navy, and Air Force to desegregate as rapidly as possible. But the Army was very much opposed to this. Omar Bradley, who was chief of staff at that time, said he did not want the Army to be an instrument of social change. In other words, he felt that America itself should take more aggressive steps toward desegregation and not use the Army as a vehicle for achieving that goal. The Army had deep, extensive commitments in the South. Many of their bases in Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Georgia, and they foresaw that if they desegregated in 1948, it would be possibly disastrous. So you're right. At the time of Korea, black troops were still segregated, and they went into the Korean War that way.
Now, the official military history of the war condemns the performance of the black troops. You've actually investigated what the performance of the black troops really were, and you've come up with a very different picture than the official military history paints.
Yes, I did. The Army, for reasons that are not clear, took a very, very dim view of the performance of black troops in Korea, particularly the 24th Regiment. And the Army, the official Army history, condemns the 24th Infantry in a most severe way. When I started my research on the Korean War, I interviewed many blacks who were in this outfit, and I began to hear a very different story from them. They felt that the Army's history had publicly lynched them, and in fact, they had done very well. And as I researched the war deeper, I found out, in fact, that they had a very good case, that many white regiments, all white regiments in Korea, during the very difficult first year, failed repeatedly and often more so than the 24th. In fact, the 24th did very, very well for a while, but its white leaders were so convinced that blacks couldn't fight. In other words, this was a sort of a, they were programmed to fail, and ultimately they did fail for a while. Then they came back and did very, very well.
The impression I have is that for white military commanders, being placed commanding black troops was not considered to be a very good position, not a very prestigious commission, and consequently a lot of the white leadership wasn't very good. That, you know, it was like the lesser leaders that were placed in the command of black troops.
Well, you're absolutely right. It was white officers, professionals, considered it to be the kiss of death for their careers to be assigned to this outfit. And this was a holdover from World War II, where the same viewpoint obtained. Therefore, those officers who commanded in the 24th Regiment were very, very poor for a while. And during the period of setbacks that the regiment incurred, they were led by these, I would say, less inspiring commanders.
Well, the Army has been asked to reinvestigate its findings on the performance of black troops during the Korean War, and I believe that there are two historians and one black general dispatched to basically reopen this case. Will you be consulting on this in any way?
No, I won't. I think that my book, which I gave to the Army some months ago in galley form, in part at least, resulted in the formation of this review board, which, as you say, is headed by a four-star black general, Roscoe Robinson. And I will not be consulted, except that my book, I'm sure, will be read by the full panel, and that my views are that the Army, really my bottom line view on it was that the Army should review and very carefully the kind of statements it had made about the black troops in Korea. There were others as well. There were several other battalions that I follow very closely, and they'll be taking a look at them too. And I think that, Pentagon review boards, I don't know what the outcome will be. Yeah, I'm sure they'll meet for a couple of years. Hopefully, they'll do something to give the blacks a better account in the Korean War. They deserve it.
The Korean War was the first war we negotiated our way out of. What effect do you think that had on military morale, and do you think that that affected in any way our entrance into Vietnam?
Well, I think that... negotiations on the battlefield are always very difficult in any situation, and certainly without question, those men who were in Korea, in the Army and Marine Corps, who were fighting on the ground, deeply resented our going into negotiations with the enemy. Of course, soldiers on the battlefield are conditioned to think only of victory, that compromises negotiations return soil, often returned soil that's been bought in blood and that type of thing. So, and then who wants to be the last person killed? So it undermines morale in that way, that you could think that I'll go out and really do well tomorrow morning, and by noon they'll have an armistice, and I might get killed or wounded for nothing. So in the very local and parochial sense, yes, it undermined the spirit of the Army tremendously.
We still have, 40,000 troops in
40,000 troops are still sitting on the DMZ, and I'm sure, I don't know, but it certainly has deterred the North Koreans from invading South Korea again. I don't know if they ever had any intention of doing that, but yes, we still have 40,000 troops in Korea.
What's your opinion of the choice of Seoul, South Korea, as an Olympic site?
Well, I think that's very exciting. How that relates to any military in there, I don't know. But I think it's really very interesting, and particularly so that the North Koreans are now apparently going to participate in about 5 events there. I don't think that'll change relations between North and South Korea, which are still bitter and hostile.
Let me ask you, what do you think the function is of military history? What function would you like your book on the Korean War to serve?
Well, I like first of all and foremost that this book would get people to remember that we did have a war in Korea. 6 million very brave men and women served in our armed forces. 40,000, 104,000 were wounded in Korea. 54,000 died. There's no monument to them in Washington. No, the war has been forgotten. I would hope that my book would remind us of that war and settle. I wrote the book more or less as a tribute to all those people who did all that and have gotten no credit, no distinction from the war. Writing military history, I think one would hope that by examining a war in such detail as I have here and raising the major problems that occurred there, such as tactic, strategy, command, black troops, and all the other factors that we go into, that the younger officer corps of today could read this and profit by it.
Do you think the Korean War was a just war?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that we were absolutely correct to go in, but not we should not have done it the way we did it. It was not just on our troops, because we threw troops in there who were not trained or not well led. It was right to try to save Korea, but we could have done it in different ways. It would have reduced our casualties. But it was almost criminal to throw our troops in the way we did. But to save South Korea, yes, I think it was worthwhile. And not only that, to show communism, Moscow, wherever, that we could be determined in our resistance to Joe Stalin's aggression. In that sense, yes, I think it was a just war.
Well, Clay Blair, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been military historian Clay Blair. He's the author of the new book, The Forgotten War, America in Korea, 1950 to 1953. It's published by Times Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.